Hey everybody, and welcome to our lecture tonight on log lines and with a coda afterwards discussing the high concept log line. So first let's jump in and talk about what a log line is, and like everybody who does this kind of a thing, I'll start that discussion out by mentioning what a log line is not. Which is to say, I'll make a distinction between a log line and a few other things that you may think a log line is. Then we'll talk a bit about the importance of log lines with some examples and why you really want to get good at this. A log line, I should make this distinction, is not a tag line or an add line. The tag line for Jaws 4, this time it's personal, is not a log line for that movie. That's the line that appears on the poster. It's usually thematic in nature. It shows that this time Jaws will have a personal theme and the shark will have a grudge against the people it attacks, etc. And it's, sometimes love surprises you. That's thematic in nature. That might appear on a poster, across the face of a major movie star is appearing in your love story. It tells us nothing about that story, except perhaps by the structuring of events. It demonstrates that love sometimes will surprise you. But it does not tell us who the protagonist is. It does not necessarily tell us what sort of a struggle they will be involved in. It leaves a lot out and a lot to the imagination. A log line is, as opposed to an add line or a tag line, a log line is a one-sentence summary of the story. It gives us some vital elements that help us understand what it will be, that gives us the most concise preview of the story we're going to have. The term log line actually comes from the studio log that was kept of all films in production. So every night it was some studio executive or operation manager's job to log the progress on the day's shooting at every project that was on the studio lot that day. And there would be a line in the log on each of these projects that briefly summarized what the movie was about. So, mining picture starring Tyrone Power, or something like that, would be the log line, and they would write down the day's progress each day on each film project, each motion picture. And that's where log line comes from. It's just a one-sentence summary of the movie that you create, in this case, to give the briefest and most concise understanding to someone who has not read the script and doesn't know what it is, what the movie is about. It is really the answer to the question, what's the movie about? If you are in a conversation and you say, I'm writing a screenplay, and someone says to you, particularly if they're in the business, if they say to you, what is it about? The answer out of your mouth should be your log line. And I happen to think that a log line and understanding log lines is very important in this industry and to writers. And I'll get into a few philosophical instances of that and a practical business application as to why that is the case. So first, let's look at it from a business angle. If you're having that conversation with someone at a party and they turn out to be the president of 20th Century Fox, and you say you're writing a screenplay and they say, what is it about? Or in any other situation where you're pitching your screenplay and trying to get someone to read it or trying to garner interest in it, probably you don't have a major star attached and you don't have the $50 million in the bank to make it, or you may not have interest from a major director. All you have to hook your audience, your potential reader, and to get them to say, yes, I should read that screenplay, I'd like to read that screenplay, or that sounds great, or that sounds cool, all you have is this log line in the absence of Denzel Washington wants to play the lead, in the absence of Steven Spielberg wishes to direct, and in the absence of I have $50 million in financing, and we begin shooting on Monday, the most attractive thing that you have, the way you get to, that you have to get people to say they want to read your screenplay is this log line. To get people to say, that sounds cool, all you have is this log line. So, it's a great marketing tool. Now, I find that writers who are artistic souls are very often against reducing their movie to a log line. They think of, well, I said reducing. They think of it as reductionist. And very often screenwriters, particularly novice screenwriters, think that the screenplay they wish to write captures all of life on a single canvas, that it illuminates every facet of the human condition. And when I've taught beginning screenwriting classes and the student has pitched a project to me and I have workshopped it with them to crystallize into a log line, and I say one sentence that sums everything up, I look around the room and every student I have is nodding except the writer of that project, who is saying, well, yeah, but it's so much more than that. And of course it is. It is so much more than that. But there's a lot of stuff that doesn't go into the log line, and it's the stuff that's so much more than that. And in a more important and, in fact, exciting way, it isn't more than that. It's just that. But it's not just that. It is the log line carried out generally in the first half of the movie into every bit of fun you can wring out of it. And then in the second half of the movie, all the places we never realized when we first heard that log line in an elevator with you 2 years ago and said, that sounds cool, let me read it, all the places we never realized it would go. All the unexpected repercussions of this idea carried out to the nth degree. And that's why it's so important that you have a real firm grip on what this log line is, because it's where you're going to continually go to get the fun for this movie. You're going to keep returning to this log line. A rewrite of your screenplay may even require a rewrite of your log line. But if you get it right in the first place, a rewrite of your screenplay may only require going back to your log line and realizing you have not wrung every ounce of fun, excitement, sexiness, coolness, appeal out of that log line. And before our lecture began today, we're talking about coming up with twists. Well, it was when M. Night Shyamalan realized, I haven't gotten every bit that I can get out of a psychiatrist helps cure a boy who is seeing ghosts, that he came up with the end twist, the place we never expected that log line to go in The Sixth Sense to the tune of $600 million worldwide. And he wisely saved that for the end. So, important as a marketing tool, it's all you have. And I have been in your position querying people to get my work read. And I can tell you, when my log line was good, my results were good. And coincidentally, when my log line was good, my script was good, and my results querying were good. So I've been on this in this exact situation, I think speaking on this very phone, to an agent wanting them to read my script And I imposed upon a USC connection. I said, hello, I'm a USC student. I've just finished a screenplay, and I know that your agent is a graduate of USC as well and has just sold the spec sort of in this vein, and I would love for him to read it. And the assistant said, well, what's it about? And I could tell, A, they really didn't want to read it, because that was going to be work, and B, that the next words out of my mouth were going to decide if they read it or not. And those next words should be my log line. And I gave my log line, which is a very brief pitch, in this case, two or three sentences, and they literally said, I don't think I'm exaggerating this in the acting at all, I guess you'd better send it over. They still didn't want to read it, so why were they telling me to send it over? I could tell by the tone of their voice. They didn't want to read it. Because the log line I said filled them with fear. And Hollywood runs on fear. And if you hear a log line for a movie that sounds like it's going to make a lot of money and be a big success, or sounds like what your boss has been saying he or she is looking for, and you don't read it, and you pass on reading that script, and they read the next day that it's sold in the trades, or it becomes a big hit, and they find out that you passed on it because you were speaking to that writer on the phone, or it crossed your desk and they were not interested in it, they could lose their job. And you must tap into this fear with the quality of your log line. Now, generally it doesn't manifest as fear. Generally it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to hear a great log line and think that would be a cool movie. So putting the fear aside for a moment, what makes a log line cool? What makes us say that's a cool movie? Well, it is generally one of three things. So I'm going to illuminate for you today what these three elements of a log line are. And I want to further stress, before I go on and do that, these are important, not just for the marketing, which I've been stressing thus far, not just for you getting your screenplay read, but for you really knowing what your screenplay is about. At USC, they made us write one-page treatments for our screenplays. We would have to do these at the rate of one a week in all 10 types of story types that they taught us. These were the exercise in the first couple of years, the first year at USC. And generally, the attitude there was, if you can't do it on one page, you will not be able to do it on 120. And we all fought it. Tooth and nail. I said, well, if it's so reductionist to put on one page, it's reducing it. There's more here. Don't worry, I can fill 120 pages. And ultimately, my own thesis professor said, if you can't do it in one sentence, you can't do it in 120 pages. So it's a great exercise which fosters discipline and, most importantly, make sure you know what your movie is about. So I always think of this, and I think I'm the only person I've ever heard say this about log lines, and maybe it's because of a particular oddity and combination of educations that I have, but the log line is the Socratic form of your movie. Okay, a brief sidebar on what a Socratic form is. Socrates, the sophist in ancient Athens, and considered by some the first philosopher, believed in finding the form of things, believed that the most important form was the form of the good or the just, and it would translate loosely to the defining essence of the thing. So he would ask in his philosophical dialogues, what is the defining essence of the good or the just? But he would say, what is the form of the good? And forms are defined loosely as, defining essence of a thing is, I think, a pretty good definition, but Socrates would always say, tell me that which is good that no other thing is, and that which only is the good and is no other thing. So your logline is the defining essence of your movie. It is that which only your movie is, and no other movie is. That which is only your movie, and is no other movie. So there are tons of movies, and your movie will be one of them. There are tons of thrillers, and your movie may be one of them. So your logline, when someone asks you what your movie is about, you don't say it's a thriller. Not if you wish to give the defining essence of the thing. You might say that, but that's not your logline, because there are thousands of thrillers in the millions of movies, and there are thousands of comedies, and there are thousands of love stories. So that only narrows it down by 2 to 10%. Still thousands of movies. I hope what I'm saying about the Socratic form of a movie will become clear with a few examples or with this exercise. There should be for every movie, every good movie, and some of the bad ones, but every movie that knows what it is about, or whose filmmakers, whose writers and directors and other people involved in the collaboration knew what their movie was about, had a handle on the defining essence of the movie. There is one sentence that I could utter to you, or the makers of that film could utter to you, and the only answer to that sentence would be one title and one title of a movie. So if I were to give it to you in a quiz format, you name the movie for which I am stating the log line, a great white shark terrorizes a beachside community, or a small town sheriff battles a great white shark terrorizing his small beachside town, there's only one movie you could say in answer to that logline. Only one movie title fits. Jaws. If I say to you, a boy and girl of different social classes fall in love aboard a doomed ocean liner, there is only one movie you could answer that fits that sentence. Titanic. So that sentence has the best hold we can have on the defining essence of Titanic. That's as close as we can get to the defining essence of the movie Titanic, the most successful film of all time. Jaws was also the most successful film of all time of its time, till it was surpassed. So, what's that sentence for your screenplay, for your movie? What is the defining essence of your story? Now, you may be like that writer that I mentioned in a class of mine who would shake his head and feel that it was too reductionist to reduce his story to a logline when it illustrated all of the human condition since man first crawled from the primordial ooze. But if I said to you, what is the defining essence of your movie? Wouldn't you feel like that was a good idea to know? Wouldn't you feel like that would guide you step by step from the first image after fade in to the last image before fade out and every step along the way? Here's another analogy. You may know this joke. How do you carve a sculpture of an elephant? get a 10,000-pound block of marble and carve away everything that doesn't look like an elephant? Well, if your movie logline is elephant, that's what's going to help you decide what parts of that block of marble do not belong in the sculpture. This is the wire that cuts the clay. The log line, the defining essence of the thing, is the wire that cuts the clay of the sculpture, is the chisel that hammers away everything that does not look like an elephant, that is not the defining essence of the thing. If the defining essence of this sculpture is to be elephant, everything else must go. And our job is all the easier, all the more easy, by having a well-defined essence and an understanding of that on a deep level. So it's important for us as marketers of our writing. It's even more important for us as writers to know that sentence, the answer for which can only be our movie. I'll give you two examples from my own screenplay, Firestorm, of log lines. One was a marketing tool, and the other was the writer's tool, the defining essence of the thing. A smoke jumper parachutes into a forest fire to guide out some trapped firefighters. But they turn out to be escaped convicts, and one of them is a hostage. He'll have to separate the hostage from the killers and save her in the biggest fire of Yellowstone National Park's history. That was a marketing tool that helped sell my screenplay, Firestorm. The logline that I always understood was the story was a smoke jumper battles escaped cons in the biggest forest fire in Yellowstone history. And that's pretty good for marketing, too, but not quite as sexy. And not everybody knows that a smoke jumper parachutes into a forest fire, so I sort of wanted to include that in the marketing. A smoke jumper battles escaped cons in the biggest forest fire in Yellowstone's history was the defining essence of Firestorm. And when I got off that track, whenever that was not happening, I knew I was in trouble, and I pulled myself back onto that guideline. Put a pin in that because I will be referring to it later in the lecture, the logline for Firestorm. So I believe a good logline has three elements that define it. So I'm going to present you with a logline template this evening, something that, you know, with these three spots left blank, that you can insert the correct items to for your story and see if they hold up and see if it defines your story better for you. There are arguably four elements, but one of them is almost always the same, so I don't think of it as a fourth element. But what should a logline be? It should be, ideally, one sentence long. The sentence should typically begin with the subject, and the subject should almost always be the protagonist of your movie, the movie's hero. The next element is a verb, and this is the part that's always the same. It's always a verb implying conflict. So there's a handful of verbs you will use. Loves, struggles, battles, fights, resists. A verb implying a conflict. The verb almost always does the same thing, and that is it shows us that there is conflict. The direct object will usually be the antagonist. There's our second element. Okay? So, a smoke jumper battles, verb implying conflict, escaped convicts. One sentence long, the subject of the sentence, usually the hero or the protagonist. I'm using the terms interchangeably. A verb implying conflict, a direct object, usually the antagonist, villain, or opponent of our hero And then I like a prepositional phrase at the end that tells us the world or backdrop in which this movie will take place. We like to be taken to different worlds. We like to have windows into places we have never been or never otherwise would be and may never otherwise go, that provide us a fantasy of what it might be like to be there. And this is one of the, I think, vital elements to a log line. And by the way, as I give this lecture, I've noted, you know, the two places where I've never heard anyone say anything else, and this is the second of them. I've never heard anyone else say that the log line is the Socratic form of your movie, because who's as pedantic as I am and would ever say that? And the second thing is I've heard other people lecture on log lines, even Christopher Lockhart, who has a great article on it on his website, Two Adverbs, and he's never mentioned that we should give some idea of which the world, in which world this movie will take place, of the world or backdrop of the movie. But I think it's vital, and I rank it close to the protagonist and the antagonist in importance. So the four elements are a hero, a verb implying conflict, an antagonist, and the world or backdrop of the movie. Try to do them just for you in that order, if you can. So the absolute generic log line into which we can shuffle the elements, or into which we can insert the elements of any movie to come up with the log line for any film that has ever been written or that we will write, is hero battles villain in a world. A hero comes into conflict with an antagonist in a specific and rarefied world. So, a sheriff hunts a great white shark terrorizing his small beachside community. Our subject, the sheriff, is the hero of our movie, hunts, verb implying conflict, a great white shark, the antagonist of Jaws, that is terrorizing his small beachside community. I put in another verb there implying conflict for good measure. But the essence of Jaws is sheriff versus shark. All right. The very essence of Jaws is sheriff versus shark. Do we really need to know that it's a small beachside community? It helps. It gives us a slightly fuller picture of what Jaws is. A boy and girl of different social classes fall in love aboard a doomed ocean liner. Okay. If I wanted to get that more into my formula, I would say a poor young man falls in love with a wealthy socialite aboard a doomed ocean liner. And there I would have it laid out much more as protagonist falls in love with. That is definitely a verb implying conflict. As a divorced man, I can swear to you it is. A wealthy socialite girl, antagonist, aboard a doomed ocean liner. If I wanted to give you a more specific idea of the world, I would say aboard the Titanic, but that would seem like cheating since I'm trying to make you say Titanic with this log line, and it would be sort of an overly broad hint, wouldn't it, as we play this game. So, as you think of the screenplay that you're going to write, and if you think of the log lines you're going to submit for me to look at in the course of the mentorship program or in our coming workshops, ask yourself, who is my protagonist? What's the best verb to imply what they're doing in the story? Who's the antagonist? And what's the world or backdrop of this story? I would argue to you that if you have those three specific elements, and just rattle them off, even without crafting into a sentence, you can probably guess what the movie is. So this is an exercise that I have not specifically performed. But I guess if I said, young farm boy, Sith Lord, galaxy far, far away, and I said, teen wizard, wizard who is the spirit of death, Hogwarts Wizard Academy, I just did hero-villain world and hero-villain world for two different movies, and you know what they are. In cases unearthed by archaeologists 75,000 years from now and movies do not exist anymore, I will say that they are Star Wars and Harry Potter, respectively. I know you enjoy them in pill form now in the future. So, these are the defining elements of a movie. I'll tell a brief story about Firestorm because I am often asked where I get ideas, and both Stephen King and I say, when asked where did you get your ideas, we both say Schenectady, New York. But I realized long ago, before I'd even bothered to think about log lines, and before I was even a teacher and realized that I had to actually have things to say about this and not just be able to do it, and I had to be able to teach it to others, and I began to analyze what I did more, I had realized that ideas tended to come to me in three stages. I had never identified what those stages were, but I had always thought, there's an idea for the file, and here's a little more, here's another thing. And then sometimes months, even years later, I would get the third element. I would feel like the idea was complete. Well, and here, for instance, is how I got the idea for Firestorm. I was driving cross country. It was between my 2 years of grad school at USC, and I had advised a friend to move out to LA because he was a screenwriter as well and was sort of in the doldrums in New York City. And I said, you'll come here. I'll introduce you to everybody in the program, and before you know it, you'll have sort of a shot in the arm as far as your screenwriting career goes. He asked me to come drive cross-country with him. I flew out to New York, and we did so. We took the northern route, and we drove through Yellowstone National Park. And there I saw a million acres of burnt forest that looked extremely eerie and scary. And to imagine what it must have been like while all of those trees were on fire was very unnerving and kind of awe-inspiring. When I arrived in L.A., probably some 10 days later, there was a news story on television saying that 15 smoke jumpers had died in the Storm King Mountain fire in Colorado. I made a note, again, in my idea file, and I still have this, that says, who are these people, the smoke jumpers? Is it possible that they actually parachuted into forest fires? If so, why haven't I seen a movie about them? There had been two movies that previous year that just featured skydiving, and that was plenty exciting enough to make a movie about, putting aside that when these guys are done with their skydiving, they're in the middle of the world I had just seen in Yellowstone National Park. Okay, I began needing a thesis screenplay to write at USC. I began to do research on smoke jumpers and wilderness firefighting. I didn't have an antagonist. I even pitched it in my thesis group. This is now November, when we're starting to pitch our thesis screenplays that we're going to write that year. And I pitched one that I didn't write for 10 years after that. But when I pitched smoke jumpers, these guys parachuting into forest fires, all I had and all I really pitched was an antagonist, a protagonist. But that protagonist does come with his own world, the world of a forest fire. And I still didn't have the bad guys. And we went through several meetings in my thesis group, my professor turning to me because he knew this was a great protagonist and a great world to set a movie in, and saying, who are the bad guys? What are they doing? And he kept asking me until one night at 4 a.m., I was reading the California Manual of Wilderness Fire Prevention, and there on a graph appeared on one axis acreage of fires, and on another axis appropriate firefighting techniques to use against fires of that size. And when fires get to a certain size, it is considered absolutely appropriate by the U.S. Forest Service to take men out of prison to fight them. And I realized that my antagonists would be escaped convicts from just such a firefighting crew. So that idea came to me in three stages, and what were they? First, I had the idea for the world when I drove to Yellowstone National Park, the world of the forest fire. Quite coincidentally, or by lucky happenstance, I heard about a unique sort of a character who frequents that world 10 days later, a smoke jumper. I had never heard of them before. Months after that, I found the third element, an antagonist, and I had a smoke jumper battles escaped convicts in the biggest forest fire in Yellowstone National Park's history. That idea came to me in three stages, in that case, quite separate from each other. And that's how you make $750,000 as a screenwriter. So, these are the vital elements of a screenplay. And again, the broad generic template is a hero battles a villain in a world. Hero versus villain in a world. Protagonist versus antagonist against the backdrop, against an interesting backdrop. So, this is what you have to have, this is what you have to know. To construct and craft your log line. And this will guide you. This will be the wire that cuts the clay. This will be the chisel that knocks off the big chunks of marble that have nothing to do with crafting this elephant sculpture. Okay? You'll want to continue asking yourself, is this my hero battling my villain in my world? This mini-movie I'm writing now? This scene I'm writing now? This beat within this scene I'm writing now, is it the hero battling the villain in the world, or is it serving that in some way that is absolutely necessary? If not, you can cut it. Is this line of dialogue the hero battling the villain in the world, or the villain counter-striking against the hero in this same world? Have I left my world accidentally? Have I left my hero? Have I left my villain? Am I giving too much time to these minor characters that are not serving these three elements? Are they coming into conflict, as my verb suggests and promises, when you first heard that log line? So that is the absolute generic log line template. Those are the three elements you're searching for in any good idea that's going to provide you with a great script to write and to plumb the unforeseen depths of as you get into the second half and the ending of your screenplay. So let's leave that for a bit, and certainly if you have questions on that, we'll take them at the end of the night. And let's talk a little bit about the high concept log line and what high concept is. I get asked this question a lot, and I honestly don't have a great answer for it. People say a lot of things about what high concept is. And I would urge you to try to come up with your own understanding of what the high concept is. People say there are generally two or three properties that everyone agrees are high concept. The idea is easily graspable and easily understood. The idea in the high concept is the attractor to see the movie. It's the reason we want to go, absent of stars or an A-list director or something like that, it being a true story, which occasionally can be a high concept all its own. The idea is easily graspable. The idea is what makes us want to go to the movie. It will often be extremely visual and feature special effects. Okay, let's look at those three things. The first two, unfortunately, are matters of opinion. So one man's easily graspable is another man's confusing. I think I know what high concept is. I have a hard time defining it. I think I know it when I see it. And I think I have a good idea of what medium concept is or what low concept is. So I think I know when an idea is easily graspable. I think I know when an idea is attractive. What would we say, makes an idea attractive? Well, we mean attractive to the movie-going demographic, meaning that people from 18 to 35, particularly male, will want to see the movie, maybe arguably 13 to 35, predominantly male, because this is who goes to the movies. If you have a problem with it, change it by going yourself and getting all your friends to go who are outside that demographic. But it's what studios are looking for. Often visual or effects driven, this is the one we'll probably focus on the most because it's the least debatable of the three. Makes things high concept a little more easily or a little more easily discernibly. And it's more easily discerned when these things are in operation, whether a screenplay is high concept or a script or a film is high concept or not. So, easily graspable, the idea is the attractor, often visually driven, featuring special effects. So, what are these ideas? Where do we find them? How do we come up with them? Okay, I'm going to give about three examples, and then I'm going to focus primarily on one. The other two examples are arguably places to go to find high concept ideas as well, and the third is probably the most fertile one. First, torn from today's headlines. Okay, something that everyone's talking about that is in the public consciousness that has become a big deal and a big thing recently and is on everyone's lips, that is on the news, that is just permeating society and all our talk and discussion, might arguably be high concept for about a one-year window if you're very lucky. So last year, to write your movie about a black presidential candidate and the plot to assassinate him with the twist that it is his plan to actually die, might have been high concept. There might have been other reasons to pass on it, but it not being high concept might not have been one of them. At the time, Michael Crichton wrote his book Disclosure, everyone was talking about sexual harassment. And to write that book with a woman sexually harassing a man was the twist that made it just high concept enough to be interesting to the studios. Of course, the fact that it's a Michael Crichton book helps a lot as well, with Jurassic Park having been in his more recent past, the most successful film of all time during that five-year period. It's really certainly debatable whether a no-name writer who was writing about sexual harassment at that time could have gone as far as Mr. Crichton did. So what's the high concept there? What's getting the movie made there? Is it the fact that it's a hot-button issue? Is it the fact that the traditional gender roles that you expect have been flipped? Or is it the fact that it's a Michael Crichton book? My money is generally on the third one. Now, however, Jurassic Park, written by almost anyone, qualifies as high concept. It certainly doesn't hurt that it was Michael Crichton who said while he was writing Jurassic Park, I'm writing the most successful movie of all time. I was well aware of what he was doing, and in fact that it was high concept. And we'll get to that when we get to our third way to generate a high concept idea or come up with things that are high concept. So the first one is, you know, it's just a natural because everyone's talking about it now anyway. It's all going on. It's torn from day's headlines. It's in the public consciousness. The second one, trickier to do, but similar to an unexpected hit. So Firestorm was written in the wake of the unexpected hit Die Hard. Die Hard was a very successful movie, more successful than anyone expected it to be, and it did something that you'll recall, if you remember the 10 story types lecture that you heard, combined two story types that we hadn't seen combined in anything but a James Bond film in a while, which was an antagonist in a caper movie and a protagonist in a detective movie trying to unveil certain vital information about what that caper was and what the antagonist was doing and then trying to stop them. And what it did with the Bond films hadn't done is it had taken what was usually just the third act of a Bond film and forced acts one and two into that same space. So while in a Bond film, it will be an intense fight in the lair of Blofeld or Goldfinger or whomever Bond is fighting in that movie at that time, usually the title character. That will usually happen in the third act. There will be a moving of the action action to a third act staging area, an oil rig off the coast of whatever, an orbiting death ray, an island where the villain has built a fortified area. While the third act staging will often move there, in Die Hard and its countless imitators, of which I've written several, everything is distilled into that area in the third act, and a much bigger pressure cooker effect is achieved because of the geographic condensing. There's a greater pressure cooker effect achieved in the skyscraper at Nakatomi Plaza, the globe-trotting world of James Bond, because it's done both in real time and with verisimilitude of place, unity of time and place, adding an intensity to it. So that was the first time that had been done in quite some time. Hero in a detective story, villain in a caper, all done in real time. It spawned countless imitators, of which Firestorm was one. If you can identify what the unexpected what the elements of the unexpected hit are and quickly come out with an imitator, that will be high concept for a while. In the 10 years after Die Hard, that was high concept, resetting Die Hard in another venue. What was being changed? One of the three elements, the world, was being changed. Often the protagonist would change, and often the antagonist as well. But we saw countless imitators, and that was considered high concept then. Now, one reason, by the way, that I don't feel so badly, that I don't have a real handle on what high concept is, and that I don't have a definition for you the way I do a log line, is high concept changes with the taste of Hollywood. And I knew it had when I took a meeting and I pitched an area in which I wanted to set a story, and an executive said to me, well, if you're just going to set Die Hard in there, I'm not interested. Whereas, you know, 2 years before that, where else you got for Die Hard? That's what we, in the 90s, I rarely walked into a room without thinking, well, how about Die Hard in here? And I actually told that story for the first time ever in a phone booth, and I had the idea for the movie that became Phone Booth, starring Colin Farrell, right then and there. So, for a while, that was considered high concept. It is not anymore. That changed. And it changed with the tastes of the public and the tastes of the studios. So let's go to our let's use that as a segue to go to our third element of what may be considered high concept, and that is that it is often very visual and will often feature special effects. What I'm saying here, and if you remember the lecture you heard on the 10 story types, is it is very often, particularly now, a supernatural story on some level. The protagonist or the antagonist or the world are supernatural. What's this mean? There is some magic involved, or there is some science involved in the world of the movie that is beyond the ken of the science we have today. Arthur C. Clarke said that any sufficiently advanced technology will appear as magic to the uninitiated, and that is true. So it is a supernatural story. Now, a few years ago, I would have said to you that while not all high concept is supernatural, all supernatural is high concept. But that, too, has changed. So the example that springs to mind when I say it has changed is a movie like Bewitched, which was made a couple of years ago now with Will Ferrell and Nicole Kidman, gets made because it's a remake of a TV show, not because there's going to be special effects and magic in it. And that movie is really considered a branded or franchised piece of material and is not necessarily high concept, or what is high concept about it is it's based on the popular TV show, not the fact that a guy married a witch. Now, the TV series Bewitched is based on a movie. It's based on a movie called I Married a Witch. And back when that was made in the 40s or 50s, I've never actually seen the movie, the fact that that witch was going to be doing magic and that the man was involved in a supernatural story may have been very high concept for them, but that's a different era of filmmaking when the high concept was not so important to movies because people didn't have TV pumping story into their house 24 hours a day. And they do now, and that's why concept has become king as it has. So a few years ago I would have said to you, while not all supernatural is high concept, the diehards of the world being an exception. There's nothing supernatural going on in Die Hard, just near superhuman feats by the protagonist, but nothing that defies the laws of physics or the laws of nature as we understand them. Nothing supernatural, just to the far ends of what we can do naturally. So while not all high concept is supernatural, Die Hard being an exception, for instance, and Firestorm being an exception, and Sudden Impact being an exception, and the Seagal one where he's a cook, and they take over his freighter, his battleship, being an exception. Under Siege, you know, being an exception. While not all high concept is supernatural, those examples aside, all supernatural is high concept. But now I can no longer say that. So I guess I have to say, the very fertile area to look for your high concept idea is in the realm of the supernatural. So, I've gotten permission from a student writing his screenplay in my mentorship program to talk a little bit about his idea and how we took it from an idea that our management didn't have any interest in into a high concept idea that now they're waiting to read. I was working with a student and casting about for an idea for him to write under my mentorship in this coming year, and He had just seen 310 to Yuma, and we spoke about, you know, how we had enjoyed that. I had actually seen it in Yuma, Arizona, just a few months before, and how it's, you know, very interesting to have a sheriff or a hired gun escorting an inveterately evil person, and the arc of that character to the point where he turns himself in or gets on the 310 to Yuma voluntarily to help the man who's been his enemy for at least the first half of the film. And we pitched several ideas of management. One of the benefits of the mentorship program is my management vets all of the ideas that that my mentees write, if you want to use that part of the program. And it's essentially allowing you to query before you write. And they're saying, yes, if we were queried with that screenplay, we would read it. And my management will, in fact, read all the scripts written in my mentorship program at the end. And we pitched several 310 to Yuma-like ideas, none of which caught their interest. So what did we do? Well, we gradually changed two of the elements in 310 to Yuma into supernatural characters. And I believe the log line that we finally came up with is the disembodied soul of an Iraqi war veteran lying escorts the dark soul of a contract killer and drug dealer to a train that will take that soul to hell. A slightly more detailed version would be the disembodied soul of an Iraqi war veteran escorts the soul of a killer to its owner, Satan, while the veteran's body lies in a coma in a hospital. So the veteran makes a deal that he'll escort this, the war vet makes a deal that he'll escort this killer to hell, where the killer has previously sold his soul to Satan, to a train, a subway train in Manhattan, in lower Manhattan, that will take the body to hell, in order that his soul will go back into his body and he will wake from the coma, and that's the deal he makes with the devil. And of course, there's a gang that doesn't want to see this killer's soul go to hell, and they're continually ambushing our hero, who must rise to a greater and greater occasion as he makes his way downtown. So I lovingly call that 310 to Hell. We have a much better title for it, but just to remind myself of where it came from and the fact that, what did we do? Well, 310 to Yuma is a Western. That's a hard sell. It got made because it was a remake. All right? Of a previously branded property. We don't have that luxury. We don't own the rights to 310 to Yuma. We do, however, have this knowledge that the supernatural is often high concept. And honestly, what did we want to do in that story? We wanted to have somebody escorting someone else and fighting onslaught after onslaught, and a secondary character, an antagonist, who sees them valiantly battling this and realizes that their cause is just and arcs and changes to reward our hero's valiant efforts. That's what we liked about 310 to Yuma, and this will have that too. So, have we sold out by taking 310 to Yuma that we loved and making it high concept? I don't think so. Have we made it high concept, and will it get read now? By management, by changing it into a supernatural slugfest, we in fact have. Now, would that feel like selling out to you? Those are your own personal boundaries to draw. But we have a nice piece of business here of a supernatural screenplay that has everything we still loved about 310 to Yuma in it. Has a chance to get noticed now, where sort of a very similar straight-ahead, sort of a remake of 310 to Yuma has already been done and wouldn't get noticed now coming from a source outside those who own the rights to remake 310 to Yuma. So there's an example of how we took the protagonist and tweaked him to a disembodied soul of a veteran lying in a coma. So what's the log line of 310 to Yuma? A Civil War vet escorts a bandit to the train that will take him to jail battling the bandits gang along the way. So we took the protagonist and we tweaked him to something, yes, supernatural. And we took the antagonist and we tweaked him to something supernatural. The world, not necessarily supernatural, although it obviously includes hell, which is a supernatural place. It's not in our understanding of nature, whatever your own particular religious beliefs may be. So, look to the supernatural when you're looking to the high concept. Now, I can say at the time I'm recording this, what's in the other two categories? What's in the news? What is everyone talking about? And what are the recent successes that nobody expected that are going to spawn imitators? There's nothing. Okay, so. If I had something in the news that I thought made something high concept, I'd be writing it. And I urge you to do your own research on that topic. And I don't think it's for me to tell you. You also have to write fast that way. You can't dawdle over your screenplay for a year if it is ripped from today's headlines. In fact, when I did in the aforementioned thesis group pitch the long line to Firestorm, my thesis professor looked at me and said, write it fast. And I did, and the rest is history. And you'll have to do that as well. Right now, I can say, you know, to be of the moment, The Hangover is a recent unexpected hit of great unexpected success. And what is it doing? It is combining a love story with a detective story, and it's a near supernatural story. It's written off with a naturalistic explanation. Those guys don't remember what happened the night before. It was done in Dude, Where's My Car? With a supernatural explanation. Those guys had their memories erased. These guys have taken a drug. The drug does exist. I'm certain at one point there was a draft where they just drank and someone said, well, I can't believe that they all forgot what happened if they just drank. Let's give them a drug. I don't think even roofies affect 100% of people with that sort of exact memory loss that goes from the exact moment you take it to the exact same moment the next day. But that seems to be what happened in The Hangover. And they have to obviously reassemble what happened that day and find the groom and save the wedding. That's a big unexpected hit, and stories like that are, I can tell you, are actively being sought in the marketplace now. And I've just sort of deconstructed what the elements are, and you can bet that I'm urging my mentees to find ideas like this. The other thing that I'm seeing a lot of, and I haven't seen anyone else identify this trend, is we will see a movie with a supernatural sort of affect to it, and it will be done both as a comedy and as a drama. So in Memento, that sort of a memory defect is so rare as to appear almost supernatural. So let's let it into the supernatural world. The protagonist of Memento cannot make new memories and is trying to solve a mystery. So there's the thriller version. In 50 First Dates, Drew Barrymore has the exact same affliction and cannot, therefore, form an enduring enough relationship to fall in love. And there's the dilemma of the romantic comedy version. So we saw it both as a comedy and as a drama. Could you take a well-known supernatural thriller and do the comedy version of it? That might indeed be considered high concept. Could the vice be versa? It might be harder for you to make us take it seriously after it's had a comedic treatment. But if you're lucky, no one will even recognize that the same thing is being done. I don't know that I've ever heard anyone but myself say, 50 First Dates, Memento, same movie. Two different repercussions of the exact same affliction or supernatural phenomenon. but in fact, they are. So the other thing I am seeing is, how shall I say this? Okay, I'll give the example, and then I will give the analysis. Liar, liar. The protagonist could not lie. There's a high concept idea, at least of its time. Ricky Gervais is about to come out in a movie called The Invention of Lying. He lives in a world where no one can lie. He's the only person who can. So the flipping of the supernatural phenomenon onto the world and making the protagonist the normal person is a twist on a supernatural idea whose time, I think, has come and that we're going to see more and more. Now, I know this a little more because of spec scripts and ideas that I've heard of sold. I believe there's a movie out there, the protagonist of which, a script that's sold and a project in development and writers have been paid, where the protagonist is the one ordinary person with no superpowers living in a city of superheroes. Okay, well, that is a flip on Superman and every other superhero movie. One person has powers in a world where no one does. Now we see the world and the protagonist are flipped. One person cannot lie in a world of liars. In the movie Liar, Liar, only one person can lie in a world of in a world where no one can. In the upcoming Invention of Lying, I had an idea and actually pitched it to several studios and came very close to being paid to write a screenplay about a man, sort of a mad scientist type, who develops a robot that looks just like him that he can send out into the world to live in his stead. And it becomes a crime fighter, and eventually the tide turns when people realize it's a robot and not a human being, and they come to where he is, to the secret base from which he is operating it. Well, if you've been to a theater recently, you've seen a trailer for a Bruce Willis film called Surrogates, where everybody in the world sends their surrogate out to live for them, and it looks just like them, only a little hotter and sexier. And they sit in a vegetative state, living the life through their surrogate. I think we all have seen movies where a man and a woman have switched place. Okay, the Steve Martin movie All of Me. Well, a woman a year behind me, a very good writer at USC. Sold a screenplay for $2 million, thank you very much, where a bride wakes up 2 days before her wedding and all women are acting like men and all men are acting like women. So what's happened there? The switch that used to happen to the protagonist and antagonist has been put on the entire world. So you see, by knowing these three elements, hero, villain, world, we have great tools which we can manipulate to change and generate ideas. I don't know if any of you have seen this novelty product, the movie Idea Generator, but it's a book of with three pages in its spine, okay, arranged vertically. So there are three sets of pages. You know, the book is divided into thirds, and the top one is always a protagonist. The middle one is always an antagonist, and the bottom one is always a world. So if the top page says a maverick cop, and the middle page says teams up with a wisecracking parrot, and the third page says to beat a drug team, well, if you flip the third page on the bottom, to beat a drug smuggler, it might say to save a wedding. So now we have a maverick cop teams up with a wisecracking parrot to save a wedding. And if you flip the parrot page, the middle one, it might say teams up with a rabbi who loves ham. Then I'll have a maverick cop teams up with a rabbi who loves ham, to save a wedding. And if you flip the first page, the very top page, it will list a different protagonist. So we might say a defrocked nun. So a defrocked nun teams up with a rabbi who loves ham to save a wedding. Okay, and you can just change and plug in those elements all you like, although I am advocating, if you wish to gravitate towards the high concept, that perhaps you start plugging in supernatural elements as best you can, or elements ripped from today's headlines, or elements that are like a big surprise hit movie that everyone is clamoring for. So, now, the first two obviously change. The supernatural seems to be here to stay. And it's become more and more likely that movies will include an element of the supernatural. Some 60 to 80% of them do, since Star Wars, in all likelihood, since effects got good. Now, why are we going to have to use effects? Why are they going to be visually? Well, we have to depict things that don't happen naturally. We can't just film it happening naturally. We're going to have to use special effects. So that's why in this third element of the high concept, very often it will require special effects, be particularly visual, be often effects driven. So while the high concept does change, I think we can see that it's trending more towards the supernatural. And the high concept idea and the high concept log line and knowing your log line is the way for an outsider like yourself to break in, to get your material read. All right. I think that concludes both the lecture on the generic log line template. Please bear that in mind as you prep log lines for future workshops and for vetting in the mentorship program. And concludes also a brief summary and overview of what we mean when we say high concept, how to craft sort of an attractive and intriguing concept using those same elements that we used to craft just the basic and generic logline. Thank you very much, everybody. I think we can stop the recording, and we'll go to Q&A for a little bit.